Welcome to AZMcast, a peer-reviewed, evidence-based podcast heavily seasoned with expert opinion. For all you new listeners, I'm going to give you a quick tutorial on how to use this podcast to its fullest potential. For you faithful veterans, you can go ahead and skip ahead to the good stuff. As you listen to this podcast, you'll hear contributors give opinions on everything from practice styles to diagnostic evaluations to emergency medicine philosophy. When you hear the bell ding, that means that the opinion is backed by evidence. Check your screen on your device to see the reference paper, and we suggest taking a screenshot for future reading. When you hear the turkey gobble, that's just our opinion, and you can decide whether you want to take it or leave it. Happy April, everyone, and welcome to this month's edition of AZMcast. This month, we get back to the science and cover a topic near and dear to every emergency provider's heart, the cervical spine. That's right, a topic so important that it's not even mentioned as the ABCs of trauma management because it's assumed you already took care of it. We will cover the unstable injuries, the conspiracy theory of C-collars, the siren song of the MRI machine for that pesky persistent neck pain, and the great border dispute of the Canadian C-spine rules versus Nexus. We have so much stuff to cover that we had to break the podcast in two with our peer review by another great U of A community alumnus in the next episode. So give yourself a big hug and squeeze your butt cheeks as we log roll you into this month's episode of AZMcast. This month, we have joining us Dr. Chris Williams and Dr. Allie Min.
Hello.
Allie just asked, why am I here? And we told Allie she's here to Paula Abdul this program right now.
That's right, dog.
For those of you that are unfamiliar with American Idol, even though it's still on, there used to be a host called Paula Abdul and another one called Simon Cowell and a guy named Randy. And Randy was kind of the in-between, and Simon was definitely the heel. And Paula, sweet Paula, is much like sweet Allie, who helps to try to bring balance to all of our sentences.
The voice of reason.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You want to sing Cold Hearted Snake again?
No. That was for the off-air testing.
So we're going to talk about cervical spine injury. This is one of those emergency medicine staples that everybody gets drilled into them. It's EMS, it's first aid, it's BLS. I mean, this is very, very basic. But as we often do with emergency medicine stuff, we make it more complicated than it has to be sometimes. So we're going to talk about what we're trying to find when we're doing a C-spine evaluation, what the exam should kind of go along with. We'll talk a bit about clearing the C-spine and all of those wonderful papers that go along with that. And then how are we going to take a look at this to see what's wrong? How many really bad, like unstable C-spine fractures do you think you guys have seen? You think you've seen like dozens, hundreds, thousands?
No.
Yeah, I would say
a dozen.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's just overutilization of the emergency department, that people will come in if they fell off a stepladder, or, you know, if we've gotten better at protecting people in their cars or something, but I just don't feel like this is something we see all the time. And of the ones that we've seen, I feel like most of them are pretty apparent when the patient rolls in. Would you guys agree with that?
I would.
So, you know, the spine, it's not something everyone possesses, but for those people that have a spine, when they break it, I hear it's painful. You know, I feel like low back fractures is something I see a whole lot more of than actual cervical spinal injuries. But you can think of the spine as having three columns. It's an anterior column, a posterior column, and then a middle column that goes all the way through. And these three columns are really what add to the stability of your C-spine. And they've got a big network of ligaments. So when you hear about a three-column fracture, that's basically taken away all the stability of your C-spine or of your spine period that allows it to shift back and forth, and this is where you start to worry about spinal cord injury. So what we try to differentiate from in the emergency department is something that is clinically important and going to be life-saving, and something that is just, you know, kind of a incidentaloma on the CT. So we're looking for patients primarily that have emergencies, and that would be the unstable C-spine fractures. There's a few of them that always come up on the test, and they want you to be able to recognize them. So even though this isn't board review, this is board review. So the mnemonic I was taught by Dr. Mike Hudson, I can't say on this program,
so I'm going to edit it.
It was Jefferson bit off a hangman's toe. Just imagine the T was substituted for something else. So, kind of going down the line is the list of the unstable C-spine fractures. So that's a Jefferson fracture, a bilateral facet dislocation, an odontoid fracture, an atlanto-occipital dislocation or subluxation, a hangman's fracture, and a teardrop fracture. And that's all we have for this episode.
All
so,
right.
And
well done.
Good job.
There's one other eponym that always gets tossed in, and this is for people who like foils and tests. So the clay shoveler's fracture sounds like it should be really bad. This is a spinous process fracture, and it is not an unstable fracture, even though I'm sure it's very uncomfortable. So there are plenty of other fractures, right? There's spinous process fractures and transverse process fractures and little anterior wedge deformities, but the ones we just described really hit the vertebral body, and that's what makes them unstable. One of the best ways that I saw this split up was into mechanism. Trauma is always about mechanism, right? Respect the mechanism. So they separated this into how the injury occurs, which is either a flexion injury, a flexion rotation injury, where not only is your neck flexed, but it's also shifted to the left or the right, an extension injury, where your head's cocked all the way back, or an axial loading injury, where you get hit from the top of the head and you just send that pressure all the way down. So the flexion injuries are going to be the teardrop fracture, the bilateral facet dislocation, and then that foil, the clay shoveler's fracture. So if you see clay shoveler's fracture, it's always the wrong answer, unless the question is, which of these is not unstable? In which case, it's the right answer. Is that too confusing?
No, I think it's crystal clear.
Is it confusing enough?
Adequately.
Okay, great. So you can imagine some of these with the flexion teardrop fracture, with the bilateral facet dislocation, that you tuck your chin into your chest, and then you get hit, and basically you're putting that stress on your neck until something either breaks or something pops out of where it should be. And all of your vertebrae sit on their facets. So the flexion teardrop fracture is going to be a fracture on the anterior inferior portion of the vertebral body. So if you crank your neck forward, those two vertebrae that are touching, one of them is going to snap off. And this produces a fracture to the ligaments on the posterior aspect as well. So now you got anterior and posterior columns that are affected. That makes it unstable. Now you've only got one other thing that's kind of holding it together. And that's similar with the bilateral facet dislocation, that you're going to see these two vertebrae either anteriorly or, in this case, probably posteriorly displaced from the facets. And that's going to be able to shift. You can imagine I wish we would just take like vertebrae building blocks. You just put them together and say, how many different ways can I break this? And there's actually only a few ways that you can break it just with impact, as opposed to, you know, shooting it or something.
I think the other thing to note for bilateral facets is that there's a 50% or at least half or more than half displacement of the overriding vertebral body. Unilateral is only about 25% displacement.
So you can get with kids this this anteriolisthesis of C2 on C3, which may look like it's a fracture. It may look like the columns have been disrupted, like there's a facet dislocation. This can be a normal variant because in children, you've got ligaments that are a lot more lax. They tend to give a little bit more. So you're going to see more of those than you will see the bony fractures. So that's a little bit of a give that's reasonable. And there's something called Swishuck's lines, which you can use to measure these out and make sure that you're not having too much displacement. And you can look that one up on your own, because if I tried to describe, let alone spell Swishuck, we'd be here for a long time.
Surprised you can say it.
Swishuck. Who knows if I'm saying it correctly?
Siri knows.
Siri knows. I don't know.
Alexa Siri knows.
Alexa, I was going to say.
Do you have an American or a British Siri?
Australian.
You have Australian. Yeah, exactly. And I had a feeling you might be one of those outliers, those Outback outliers. So. All right, so these are the flexion injuries. These are dangerous, and you can imagine if you just take a pen or something and you just kind of bend it in the middle until it pops, you're going to have that break in the back and the break in the front. That's exactly what you end up with. So the other option with this is a flexion rotation injury. So this is where the head is not just flexed down, but the chin is pointed at one shoulder or the other. And this gives more of the stress on one facet versus the other. So you can get a unilateral facet dislocation, which is still a problem, even though it's not something that may need to be rushed to the OR. It's still problematic. Or you can get what's called a rotary atlantoaxial dislocation. That is far too much Latin in one phrase. But surprisingly, I've seen this a couple times. And the two residents that have seen this with me will probably never forget it. Jeremiah Garrison had one of these with me. And he confided in me that this is one of the few times he's ever really been worried about a patient. He called him the next day and wanted to make sure they were okay. And so I wanted to commend him for being worried about a patient.
Did you send them home?
Yeah, we sent them home.
Oh, wow.
So it kind of depends on where it is. You can get the atlanto-occipital dislocation, which basically is an internal decapitation. And that's a pathology diagnosis, because that's somebody who you're not going to be able to fix.
His head fell off. I've seen that once, actually.
You've seen this one?
Yeah.
Was it on Dumb and Dumber?
Was it a bird?
It was somebody who came in that wasn't going to survive, but ended up getting a CT anyway somehow.
And I just thought he was
really quiet.
Pretty bird.
You're sick.
Aaron, in these cases, do you obligatorily get vascular imaging as well?
We didn't in this case. Here was the scenario, and this is not like super well described, but it's enough that, you know, those times where you've learned something in residency, you read it in a textbook, you saw it on a blog, and you were like, if I ever see a radiologist put those words, I know it's time to sound the alarm, right? And then you sound the alarm, and whoever's on the specialist on the other end is like, and so? Well, but they have Brugada syndrome. Uh-huh. Are they alive? Yeah. Well, you can send them to my clinic. We'll talk to them about putting in a pacer, do risks and benefits, have them fasted, all that. Wait, you guys aren't as excited about this as I am, you know? So I got this twice. I had a little kid. One of them fell from about 3 feet, and the other one was knocked over by the family dog, and they both came in with torticollis. They just had their head turned to one side. And they walked in, which is the important part, and then they just sat there, and they played with toys, and they talked to us. One of them I actually have on a consented video of, he just won't look at you. He'll look with his eyes, but he won't move his neck, and it's creepy. And so it wasn't subtle. Something's wrong with this kid. And the first time we did it, we scanned the kid's neck, and they said rotary atlantoaxial dislocation. And we called neurosurgery, and they said soft collar, follow up in a week. I said, unbelievable. You guys aren't going to put this kid in a halo or something? They said, he's neurologically intact, and these often will reduce on their own. And I read through it and did some lit search and was like, these can be managed anywhere from a soft collar to open surgery. It all depends on the case. So this was a minor trauma, and we did call the kid, and the kid eventually did better and just kind of slowly popped his way over, followed up with neurosurgery, and I looked at their notes, and he did fine without surgery. surgery.
No surgery.
The other one did the same thing, so I was less surprised the next time. But it was very obvious when doing this exam there was something wrong with this kid's neck. So we absolutely need to find this. You can't say, I don't know why he'll turn his head. Why don't you go follow up with his pediatrician on Wednesday? You know, it's got to be something that we find. But the important part was that he was neurologically intact. Another kid that I had that had the similar injury that ended up getting the halo was not neurologically intact. He was a wrestler and was thrown by his head in like as a shoulder throw, and said he hit the ground and felt an electric shock go through his whole body. And we're like, no, you're going straight to the MRI. And he had the same thing of where you can see his head was pointed in one direction and his vertebrae were pointed in the other. And they put him in a halo. And then they took him up to the ICU. Everybody's ready to intubate or anything we need to do. And they just ratcheted down the halo little by little, little by little, little by little. Pow! And then his head just cocked back into place. It was one of the freakiest things I've ever seen in my life.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And made me very thankful I'm not a neurosurgeon.
What kind of neurodeficits did he have when he arrived?
So he just had paresthesias kind of throughout the whole body. He was like, no, everything feels like pins and needles. We're like, good enough for me, you know. He did not have a hard neurodeficit, like I can't move my toe or, you know. He didn't have anything that had an obvious motor deficit. But he said, I feel numb and paresthesias throughout my whole body. Which always, paresthesias is one of those ones that always gets me, of like, how much are you feeling that's legit and how much of it is like, I'm sure you're fine.
You're freaked out. You're hyperventilating. Yeah.
There goes another sport my child is not doing.
Wrestling? That wasn't on the top of the list?
Or wrestling.
Wrestling.
Wrestling was.
Probably okay.
Right. Wrestling doesn't cause injuries.
So flexion injuries, flexion rotation injuries will kind of pop the head out of joint. The extension injuries are the ones, they're a little less common, but they used to be a lot more common. The spondylolisthesis of C2, also known as the Hangman's fracture. So with the Hangman's fracture, I always thought that this was, you know, you choke to death or something, but it actually, if they do it...
Judicial hangings.
Yeah, judicial mm-hmm. hangings.
Like, yeah, there was lots of debate back in the day when they did much more of these judicial hangings. Whether it was better to tie the knot with 13 knots or 12 or 14 loops, you know, the thickness of the rope, and then debate about whether it was better to put it right in front of the chin. And there was a lot of debate and argument that it was better if you moved it off by, you know, 15 to 30 degrees to one side. And unfortunately, they never did studies in those, so we don't know. But a lot of debate.
Unfortunately? Is that a big question we still need to answer in this day and age?
Well, you know, whether your mechanism's worse from a pure extension standpoint or if it's more of one of these extensional rotational mechanisms, right?
I love that you know that, Chris Williams.
I count on Chris knowing stuff like this to spice up what would otherwise be a very boring Latin-y podcast. So. But that's the Hangman's fracture. It's C2, and this is going to be a fracture line right along the pedicles of C2. It's not going to be subtle. It's a very unstable fracture, and so it's usually with a sudden extension jerk of the head, and similar with the extension teardrop fracture, where you get the other way where the head is. The flexion teardrop fracture was you flex the neck too far forward and you break, and the extension is you flex it too far back and you break. So with that mechanism, this is somebody trips and falls and lands chin first onto a table or something, hyperextends, you can break your neck that way.
What's interesting is they both involve the anterior segment of the vertebrae. I would have thought that an extension mechanism would cause a posterior injury, but it's still flexion injury. So the mechanism matters, but the way the radiograph looks will be fairly similar.
And the other thing, just to throw out, if you haven't, especially you have, it seems like an old person that comes in, they fall, they catch their chin onto a countertop or something, and they have symmetric strength bilaterally, but upper extremity less than lower extremity. You have to be suspicious for
central cord.
This is from Matt Bergman. Mm-hmm. They can walk to the fridge, but they can't get a beer.
Mm.
And that is just a sad state for anyone to be in.
That's a tragedy. Yeah, and it's important to note, I mean, we're talking about bony injuries and ligamentous injuries. We're not talking about spinal cord injuries, which could be a whole other two-hour-long podcast for a future date.
Yeah. Hey, Allie, there's three types of odontoid fractures. Do you mind describing them all for us real quick? Go ahead.
Sure. There's type 1 through 3. I'm not going to describe type 1 because everybody knows what that is.
What is it?
You
what
know.
Part?
You know. Every time we give the lecture, we have to have a discussion about the tip, and it goes on for about 10 minutes.
We'll make it shorter.
Anyway. All right. Type 2 is at the base of the odontoid, and then type 3 extends into the vertebral body of C2. And I think the odontoid views are interesting when you're talking about the Jefferson fracture, because you're looking at the alignment of the lateral masses of C1 to the vertebral body of C2. And that's, again, probably more for history.
And that's also how you'll pick up the that atlanto-axial dislocation, all on that same view.
So the last one is the axial compression injury. So this is the diving injury. This is somebody dives into a shallow pool, and they land head first, and everything just gets, you know, 12-car pile up, and you get a burst fracture of C1. That's the Jefferson fracture.
I've seen this twice now, and both have been with cyclists.
Really?
Mountain bikers. Yeah.
I actually had one in a rollover MVC where it was someone that wasn't wearing their seatbelt. And what we postulated is that when they rolled over, they went head first into the roof, mm-hmm. and that crushed down. So, I'll be honest, other than diving, that's the only other time I've seen this, is somebody who you really have to take a complete header, like straight down, and hit your head on the pool with quite a bit of force. But Chris, you're saying like head first, like speared from cycling? Or
yeah, just going, taking a gnarly drop. Can I say that? Does that make me sound a little too poser? And goes end over and lands just straight on their vertex. But one of the cases presented like 2 or 3 days later, and it was only at the point of paresthesias and maybe having a hard time holding up his coffee that he decided to come in. Pretty hardcore.
I feel like we all hear stories about those. Even though these are fairly rare, I guess when it does happen, everybody wants to talk about it, right? So you hear stories about those people like, oh, they were in a car accident last week and they've been walking around and then finally went in to be seen and they scanned them and they've got like some awful, might I say, gnarly fracture, you know, that they've just been walking around with for a week, and you just wonder what would have happened to that person. The Phineas Gage of C-spine fractures, right? So these are the unstable fractures that you need to be able to pick out, not just from a test, but from CT. And I'll say that these are probably, these are all from the era before MRI. And so you would see them on X-ray, and you would see them on CT. I still look at my CTs in the sagittal view because I was taught to look at these X-rays. I don't know what the youngins are doing when they look at CTs, if they're looking at them at all.
The kids these days?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, they're still doing, I think they learn from us, and so they're seeing us go through the sagittals. I can sometimes look at an axial and say, oh, I see the injury, but then I'll scroll through it and I'll see the same injury on every single vertebrae and realize that's just the normal anatomy. Right. So I'm not as good on the axial cuts, but definitely have to rely on coronals, but even more so sagittals, because I'm just, like Aaron, used to looking at those X-rays. So who gets X-rays? So nobody gets X-rays, right?
No.
No. So the only time I get X-rays is if I don't think a patient needs imaging at all. Okay. And they're kind of feeling the vibe from them, like, doc, I'm not leaving here without imaging. I'm having neck pain. I want an X-ray or an image of some sort. And then I'll say, you know what would be really good? I mean, I really don't think you have an injury, but I'd sure feel a lot better about this if we had an X-ray that was normal. And then I just hope that the X-ray is normal.
You liar. So I'm going to Mosier here since he's not here. So, I mean, aren't we being a little disingenuous? I mean, here's the thing. You know, if I have these patients that come in and they were in a car accident and you just keep hearing like vitriol and just spit coming from them, they're going to sue that person. And they're looking for evidence at that point. And I kind of want to get out of the way of that train. There was a paper a kind of a position statement by the American College of Radiology that said they don't recommend x-rays for anyone for C-spine at all. Like, you shouldn't be doing an x-ray for C-spine. You should only be doing it if you think you've got an airway foreign body, or maybe, you know, a retropharyngeal abscess, somebody, you know, something like that. But for actual clearance of your C-spine, you shouldn't get it. So I feel like doing the x-ray is, I'm doing a test that I know isn't going to do anything based off of my clinical evaluation, and put myself in harm's way for doing a bogus test versus doing a CT. And in a lot of even my peds population, they're so thick I can't get a good x-ray. Mm-hmm. And then the radiologist says, if you really want to know, you should get a CT. How do you mitigate that?
Well, I don't get an x-ray if they're in a collar. So if they're in a collar, I'm not getting the x-ray, because I just assume that they're going to give me a read that says, you know, hard to evaluate due to secondary to collar, loss of the natural lordosis, which you'll see even with the CT. So I'm not doing that. So the collar's already off if I get the x-ray. I can do flexion extension, which increases my sensitivity. And it's only going to be a problem if they do have an injury, right? They're not suing you about it if they don't have an injury. So if they do have an injury, of course I'm not getting the x-ray, I'm getting a CT. So I only do it if I think if there's nothing there, and I'm only doing it if the patient is completely insistent, or I get the vibe that they're insistent on some form of imaging. And at that point, I unabashedly do it, not for medical reasons, but for customer service reasons. I want to keep Banner happy. I want to improve my flow. And so I'm not getting the CT, so I'm improving my flow. And that's it. That's my only reasons for ever doing an x-ray in that situation. Unless I've been out of the country. And so, you know, let me channel Brad Dreyfus. You have to know how to evaluate and interpret C-spine injuries with an x-ray. When I worked in New Zealand for a little bit, I had to learn how to read x-rays really, really fast, because that's how we evaluated the majority of those people. And same thing, I'm sure, in Africa.
I think that's fair. I think as long as you're, you know, open with the patient of like, look, if you'd like an x-ray, I can get you an x-ray. I don't think an x-ray is going to help. I don't think it's going to show anything based off of these things. But you're telling me you want an x-ray? Yes, I want an x-ray. Well, here's your x-ray. Versus, okay, well, just to make sure nothing's wrong, and I don't think anything's wrong, we'll get an x-ray just to make sure. Because I think even though it's phrasing, it's a little tough if, you know, God forbid something does happen and they end up with something. It's like, the doctor told me my x-ray was normal.
And it was.
Maybe this is the overly worried side of me. But yeah, I think that I don't think anybody should really get x-rays. I think for the back, I'm probably a little more cavalier about, yeah, just get some x-rays and give them some pain meds. And if the x-rays are normal and they feel better after the x-rays, that's my time trial.
I'm the exact opposite on the back.
Really?
Yeah, I won't get x-rays for the back.
Why not?
Very interesting. I'm too used to getting the equivocal reads. I don't get as many of those with my neck x-rays. And I don't order a ton of neck x-rays. I don't want to make it sound like I order them all the time. Very, very infrequently. But I can't remember the last time I got an x-ray of the back. If I'm at all worried, I'm getting a CT. And if the patient's otherwise kind of pushing me for imaging, I'm just going to tell them why it's not indicated and move on. That's just my little idiosyncrasy. Now you know more about me in my soul.
Well, and I feel like, again, we're talking about patient population. If you can't get a good view of a patient's neck because they're obese, mm-hmm. you're definitely not going to get a good look at their back. Yeah. So for me, when I'm dealing with kids and they're complaining of back pain or something, let's give them a little Tylenol, ibuprofen, and then we'll check and see how they're feeling afterwards. And so for me, I find that's a little bit better. And I've been surprised a couple times with, oh, you do have a fracture. What do you know? You know? And those kids also didn't feel better after Tylenol and ibuprofen. So what do you do, Allie?
I can't remember the last time I've ordered C-spine x-rays, as I was just sitting here thinking about it. I think I try to have good discussions with patients if they're actually worried about a neck injury. But I'm trying to remember now, but I really don't think I use x-rays in my algorithm at all. And if I'm going to get any sort of imaging, I think I go right to CT. If I really feel somebody's low risk, then I'll try really hard to convince them they don't need any imaging. I think I was just thinking about board review. C-spine x-rays seem like the kind of thing that are akin to fundoscopic images of the retina.
Yeah.
We teach them and we learn them because they're on our exams, but in reality, we're rarely looking at the back of the eye or looking at x-rays of the cervical spine. I think they're interesting, but clinically, I don't really use either.
They look great in a museum of emergency medicine. Mm-hmm. Like, remember these? What are those? What are those, Grandpa? These are radiographs. You used to print them on something we called film. So
that's right.
So I think that x-rays are, for the most part, out if you're actually concerned about something. Whether or not you want to use them is like a photo booth from the ER of like, hey, here's your souvenir for coming to the ER after your car accident. Here's a picture of your neck.
A lollipop from the ER.
Exactly.
I think that's practice, and you can decide what you're going to do. But CT is really where we go for this. And usually when I'm looking through the CT, I start with the sagittal because you can see the most spine.
Well, you see the lines. You're worried about those three lines, you can get all three lines in the same view.
You can look and see if they're contiguous, if there's a nice natural curve to them, or if one is off. You can see if there's height disruption or height variability between the vertebrae, and you can look for those little chips and fractures. If you don't look at your head CTs or your C-spine CTs after they're done, you really should, because you can pick up stuff that you can then, if you see it, there's something that needs to happen, right? Like, you're not going to pick up the little chip off of the spinous process, but that's not necessarily something you need to pick up right away. You will pick up if there's actually a disruption of the ligaments and there's a 50% displacement of the vertebrae. So I scan through the sagittals first, and then I go through the axials because it's a lot easier to pick up that burst fracture going down that way.
I gotta say, I love the odontoid views on cervical spine, so I like looking at that area on the CT scans.
All right, so the CT we've gone through, you've looked at it, and you go back and you say, all right, patient, you don't have any fractures. And you start to hear the Kardashian whine, and it still hurts, right?
Uh-huh.
They've got that collar on. Try to take off the collar, and what you hope for is you take off that collar and they feel better, right? But they don't. They feel worse, and everywhere you touch the hair at the nape of their neck, and it's hurting. And you try to convince yourself that there's nothing wrong, but man, that patient is still sore. Now what?
You rip the collar off, you throw it in the garbage, and you discharge them.
Paula?
Or you consider an MRI.
So those are your options, right? I mean, there's really only... Well, I guess the other option is you've now bothered me to the point of where I'm going to punitively keep you in this collar. I want to put you in the soft collar. You put them in the cone of shame, and you discharge them.
No, you're going to upgrade it to a $700 version of the cone of shame, and then you're going to discharge them.
That's
home.
Right.
Well, this started bothering me pretty quickly after I became an attending, and I started reading through notes, okay? So I'd read through this trauma note, and the note would read, patient assessed positive C-spine tenderness, and so unable to clear C-spine. Obtained CT scan, CT's negative, collar removed. They never went back and documented patient's pain has decreased. Or they lie and they say, I reevaluated the patient. All their pain magically is gone now because that collar, which increases pain, and laying flat for the CT, which increases pain, has now magically cured their pain. And now I'm going to lie to you and say that they don't have pain, so I removed the C collar. It drove me nuts. And what is the learning point there? The learning point there is that the collar wasn't doing them any good in the first place, and they are clinical kind of haggis for them having a C-spine injury was so low that they didn't think they needed to keep that collar once they had a negative CT.
So I think that you've got a CT that shows you have you're lacking in fracture, right? Your spine is in place and you're neurologically intact. This is a patient that may have a ligamentous, strain. They may have just really intense muscle strain, which is whiplash. I mean, that's just what you expect after this kind of an injury. What you're looking for is that they've disrupted all these ligaments, but they don't have any risk What you're looking for is that they've disrupted all these ligaments. They just don't have any bony proof of it, right? So this would be somebody like a patient that has rheumatoid arthritis, that you worry about them having an unstable C-spine because of their inherent joint issues. This is one of the pediatric patients with somebody with trisomy 21 that you know has an unstable C-spine. These are patients you need to go that extra mile for. Just the general patient that's still having pain, I'm not so sure. I don't know that these patients need an MRI now. They may need an MRI to find it out, because again, we're trying to find the dangerous things, but you can find more stuff. It's just, can I do something about it today in the ER? If I can't do something about it on this visit, it's not worth me finding. And that's my opinion.
But. Yeah, your goal at that point is to say, not do they have a potential ligamentous injury. It's at that point, in my opinion, do you have a ligamentous injury that is unstable? Okay, something that is, it's like this threading the needle, where you have some injury that is unstable, but you don't have any neurodeficits that is prompting an MRI, and that's really threading the needle to the point where it's almost I can't say I've ever seen it a situation where someone is not displaying any stigmata of neurocompromise, but then an MRI shows that they have an unstable ligamentous injury. So if you're discharging them home without the MRI, but they're still in significant pain, to me, what I'm saying is, you know what, rather than taking the 45 minutes to 4 hours for an MRI, I'm going to spend 5 minutes with the patient and explain to them, you do not have a bony injury based on your CT scan. I think the likelihood that you have an unstable injury is so low, ridiculously low, and I'll explain to them what I mean by unstable injury, that I think it would be improper for you to stay here for an MRI. However, if outpatient you continue having these pain and symptoms, that would be the next step. And you get an MRI, and if it shows that you have a ligamentous injury, now you have a name for your pain, then you have some prognostic information at that point too, but it's not indicated emergently.
I agree, and I would add that I think mechanism of injury comes into play when I'm making these decisions about patient disposition and whether or not further imaging is necessary.
Yeah, I think the difficult part is when you have those N of one. I had one patient, and this happened to me one time. I think if it happens to you, you have to figure out a way to overcome that. If it happened to somebody else that you heard about, I mean, now with social media, it's easy to share this stuff and be like, did you hear about this time that this happened? It's like, well, you know, you don't want to shred somebody's clinical practice style and say, well, it was because you failed to do this, this, and this, and that's why you missed this C-spine injury. I do feel like when we're really concerned about it, we just go, do you still have pain? Yeah. I should really do a good neuro exam and try to figure out, does this patient really have a C-spine injury? Otherwise, if you're just saying, like, do you still have pain? Yeah. All right. Well, you're getting an MRI then. I mean, that's not really what's going to help the patient. There's even literature to say that you can clear a patient's C-spine who's intoxicated, obtunded, as long as the CT is negative. And the chances of them having something bad is exceedingly low. Not zero, but exceedingly low. So these are patients that you need to re-eval. You need to go look at them and say, hey, that alcoholic patient that came in that we cleared their C-collar because it was negative, the CT was negative, they're not moving their left arm now. Okay. Problem, we need to go in and, you know, reassess this. But some of these things are just impossible to find. We can't MRI every unclearable person with a bad TBI. I like the way one of these papers phrases it in their abstract. They said, MRI identifies additional injuries. However, the vast majority are of minor clinical significance. Routine MRI after a negative CT of the C-spine is not supported by the current literature. So it fits into your practice style, but I would say that not everyone needs to have an MRI. MRI right afterward.
So taking a minor step back, you mentioned something, Aaron, patients who are obtunded, intoxicated, negative CT. So my question for you guys is, if you have, say someone's really drunk, like they have really no exam that you can rely on, and they're just kind of passed out on their bed, but they have obvious trauma, say maybe fall down, go boom or something. You get the CT, and you threw in the C-spine too because you just didn't have any collateral information. And so you get a negative head, negative C-spine. They're drunk as a skunk laying in their bed. Do you take their collar off at that point, or do you wait for them to sober up, reeval, and then clear the quote-unquote clear their collar?
So I'll tell you what I do is I leave the collar on them, and when they wake up and take their collar off, they are now cleared.
Mm-hmm. I would say that's pretty standard. Yeah.
And honestly, my reasoning for using that is the same reasoning for what keeps me from scanning small children with C-spine injuries. Is if you are in, have you guys ever seen a kid come in those KED boards mm-hmm. where they're strapped in, they can't move everything, they look like they're in a sarcophagus. And if you open that KED board, take off the Velcro, and they spring to life like a caged animal and jump for the first person they can see, their C-spine is clear.
Yep.
You know? Kids are really good at protecting their injuries. Now, alcoholics are not, but I will say that once you're able to take off your own collar, benefit to risk ratio of me keeping you down to keep this collar on, or you know, putting this intoxicated patient through an MRI, it doesn't add up for me.
Well, they're not moving much. And so that's been my beef with this, is that you get the negative CT, you go back and evaluate the patient, and they're just drunk as a skunk. Taking that collar off isn't putting them, to me, at increased risk because they're not moving. And by the time they start moving enough that they're going to take their collar off, well, then they can be reevaluated at that time.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think
the same reason we will clear collars on intubated patients. You know, they're not moving.
They're not at risk to injure themselves.
Right. Now, I will give, for the MRI lovers out there, I will give credence to SCIWORA. For those of you that don't know SCIWORA, it's spinal cord injury without radiographic abnormality. Now, this is another term that's probably like PEA. It's an archaic term for when we didn't know what was going on, but now
and that's being supplanted by improving radiographic
right.
abilities. So PEA is going away yeah. more so as we get better ultrasound, and well, to some degree. But SCIWORA, you know, that when you and I were training, that was really important because we did a lot of this with X-ray and then CT, and now if you got an MRI, does it have to be an MRI negative before it's SCIWORA? Or
so yeah, the spinal cord injury without radiographic abnormality meant that you had a negative X-ray, you had a negative CT, and yet something is still wrong. This kid's still not moving their legs. They're still not acting appropriately, and I think that these are a misnomer now, because you know, any resident nowadays, any intern in July would be like, well, they need an MRI. So it's kind of an archaic term. It just doesn't describe what we used to see. It's a problem we don't have anymore. We go straight to MRI now. But it gets back to the important part, which is a good neurologic exam in a patient that you're worried about has injured their C-spine.
So a lot of you are probably asking, like, well, what's the big deal? Why the impetus to take the C-collar off of a drunk person? Quickly. It's their tether. Just tie a little rope to it, tie it to the bed, they'll be fine.
Put a Foley in them and an IV, and that patient will never leave.
Like the posy vest. Do we use those?
Oh, gosh, the posy vest.
The posy vest. Remember? Yeah, those are sad.
It's the posy vest, for those of you that have never seen it, because I'm pretty sure it's like up there with waterboarding as far as torturing patients. We would just tie these patients by a vest to the bed.
Very sad.
So the question is, you know, why the impetus to take these collars off? Why do some attendings feel so hell-bent on removing these collars? Do you think they cause any injury? Are they deleterious in any way?
I think that the C collars produce more pain in patients. I think that if I'm truly worried, then the pain of a C collar is worth the risk of, you know, figuring out what's going on. And there's a lot of it that is, ingrained in us from ATLS and from BLS and from every paramedic that's out there that knows that we have to put this on because this is our protocol.
Right.
But the question of does it cause harm, I feel like there are some situations, especially something like the atlanto-occipital dislocation, where you've got a facet that's off and a person with torticollis. The two kids that I've had with this, I did not put them in C-collars.
Right.
Because if I apply manual traction of like, oh my gosh, there's something wrong with your neck, hurry, let's get it back into alignment, that's going to cause trouble.
You've either fixed it or killed them. So, yeah. You know, flip a coin. But the question of whether it causes any harm is, it's more than just does it actually cause injury to the patient. I would argue that pain is harm in some degree. And so, you know, if it's pain versus pithing your patient, then of course you allow them some pain. But if you're pretty confident that they don't have any pain or any harm, then I don't want to keep them in that pain.
I will quote Princess Bride to say that life is pain.
Well stated.
And for those of you that have not still watched Princess Bride, shut off the podcast.
Shame.
Go watch Princess Bride.
That's right. But in addition to pain, you're increasing ICP. You're increasing the probability that your CT will be read abnormally with that loss of natural lordosis, because what can cause that? Ligamentous instability. Ligamentous injury can cause that. So the radiologist is going to say, well, you've got the loss of the natural lordosis of the spine, which if they're throwing you a bone, they'll say maybe secondary to the C collar, but they may not. And then you're kind of stuck with saying, and they'll say correlate clinically. You're like, well, clinically they have a neck injury. That's why I got the CT. And then I think you're creating more problems for yourself at that point. From an airway standpoint, it's a huge deal. And we haven't even discussed penetrating trauma, but there's increased mortality on C-collars with penetrating trauma, which I think everyone agrees you shouldn't put in that situation.
And not only is there increase in mortality, the reason why there's increasing mortality is not because of the vascular congestion or anything that you get. It's because people don't see the bullet wound to the neck, and people don't reassess for an expanding airway hematoma or other issues related to that because there's a giant collar over top.
Yeah, and you know, all of us have done intubations in patients that are collared, and I think it's pretty standard at this point to now at least undo the Velcro of the chin, which allows us a little bit of that jaw thrust, and someone else is just kind of holding the spine in place. I think, to be completely honest with you, if we just remove the C-collar altogether and we're still worried about the C-spine, we would do a better job of controlling the C-spine and immobilization than we do with that collar, because I think that collar gives us a false sense of security. In a minute, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the wilderness stuff. But just as to highlight one thing before that, how good do you think your C-collar is at immobilizing a patient? And, you know, they've done studies on this with both live patients in pre-hospital mock ambulance or mock MBC. And they found that if you ask the person to pretend that their neck's broken and to be very careful being extricated from a car, they move their cervical processes with motion capture. They use motion capture marks over each spinous process. They move it less.
Like Gollum?
Like Andy. Gollum, and, yes,
like
exactly.
Andy Serkis kind of stuff?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And they move it less than they do if they tell them to just go limp and let EMS take them out in a collar. And then they've done cadaver studies as well, where they have seen how much just normal run-of-the-mill jostling with log rolls and moving up onto a backboard and transferring. How much do those cadavers move when they're in a collar? And a collar only reduces their movement to about 40% of their normal range of motion. And if you add a backboard to it, it decreases it a lot more at that point. But at that point, you've added bolsters and you've duct taped their head down. So a collar by itself really should just make you think, this is a reminder to me that this person has an injury, but it's not like you can jostle them around. So for me, if I'm really worried about their neck and I want to worry about an airway, I just open up the collar completely and I have someone else say, I tell them, you're in charge of keeping that spine immobilized, but I tell my airway person, your job is to get the airway.
I remember having a trauma surgeon tell me one time as a medical student, we were in this guy's belly trying to find the bleed from a gunshot wound, and he grabbed my hand and he put it on the proximal aorta, and he said, push down and do not let go. If you let go, he will die. And man, I have never pushed so hard in my life. Like, I thought for sure, like, all right, well, this is on me. And I feel like that's essentially what you're telling somebody, of like, you hold their airway, you grab their shoulders and squeeze their neck between your forearms, and do not let them, you know, be jostled around easily. But there's even like question about whether those little minute head movements are going to be the ones that are going to piss them, you know? And that's not said with a lisp, but that's P-I-T-H. For those of you who don't know that term, that's to actually, you know, sever the cervical spine. And
insert Mike Tyson sound effect right there. Yeah.
I think that was on an episode of ER.
Yeah.
Right? Ankylosing spondylitis. There was some guy who had that, and they broke his neck when they intubated him.
Yeah. And there are some of these things that are legit. You know, there are pediatric conditions, there are rheumatologic conditions that put you at higher risk for having a spinal cord injury and for having a broken neck. I mean, I get so nervous about every time I see these kids with osteogenesis imperfecta come in with just, you know, they reach over for a water bottle and their arm breaks. I'm like, man, if something happens to one of these kids where I have to intubate them, you come up with a plan of how you're going to address it ahead of time. There's no reason to be in fear of these kids, but you have to have a healthy fear of what you're going to do. I think that the notion of, you know, I let this person move their neck and then they, you know, became a quadriplegic is probably not the reality.
It's not panned out in the literature. It's just not. Every single case that they have used to point to pre-hospital inadequate immobilization causing the injury, on further review has found that that was either documented by the pre-hospital themselves, or identified by the pre-hospital and continued to decline anyway, or it happened after presentation to the hospital. Not a single case has ever been documented where improper immobilization has led to clearly led to any kind of permanent injury.
So we worry about this, and we worry about it so much that I agree with Chris. I think the C-collar makes you feel that you're doing something to prevent worsening injury. And there's question, this is one of the big emergency medicine conspiracy theories of, you know, where you just shout out like, but there's no evidence to support it. I'm like, there's no evidence to support a lot of the stuff we do. And to a degree, you can say that there's some common sense about maintaining cervical spinal immobilization. Now, how you do it is what's kind of up for debate. Mm-hmm. So, Chris, what are some other ways that you maintain cervical spinal immobilization?
So the times that I've in the hospital been forced to immobilize the spine in a patient I'm kind of worried about, but the C-collar is just not available or doesn't fit the patient, or their position of comfort just doesn't fit the C-collar. So all of those are things that we've mentioned. How do I improvise something? And my go-to is towels, and I'll roll two towels alongside the patient. This is great in those really bull-necked, no-necked patients. And you put these two bolsters basically along each side of their head, and you hold it in place, and you duct tape over it. And then the other is with a SAM splint. And this is not a very visual medium that we're using now, so I can't explain to you exactly how to do that, but just know that there is a method for using a SAM splint for a C-collar that works very, very well.
I do think there's more to keeping the head still compared to wrapping something around someone's neck. I've heard it said before on from lectures or podcasts or blogs about maintaining an airway in a small kid, of like, you've got them intubated and you want to maintain their airway because they're very tenuous, and you move them one way or another and then they're going to extubate, just put a C-collar over them. And I just can't get with that. For reasons that you stated, of it increases ICP, and that's not something you want to do in a little kid you've just intubated, especially if it's for a reason, like maybe it's a neonate that was just delivered, not good, that leads to hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy. Maybe it's a non-accidental trauma. Maybe it's some of these kids that you do get more worried about. So I think you can immobilize the neck without wrapping something around it. However, in this day and age, the easiest thing to come by is surprisingly not towels and duct tape. It's a cervical spinal collar.
Well, I keep duct tape in my bag, so there you go.
Of course, you do.
I've been meaning to talk to you about that. That's really creepy. Duct tape and, you know, leather gloves. It's really weird.
Tennis ball.
Two tennis balls and a sock.
Well, I think that the C-collar does give us one thing that we can provide to the patient, and that's that it gives the patient a sense that I have actually helped them feel better today by taking it off. So they come in a C-collar, and they've gone through whatever algorithm has been initiated before I was involved, and they get their imaging, and then I come back and I say, congratulations, we get to take this really horrible, very uncomfortable thing off of you, and they say, oh, thank you, doctor, you've helped me so much today when I take it off. And so that, to me, that's the benefit.